Okay, good morning, everybody. This is Bio 241, and it is September 3rd. Is that right? No, September 4th. Okay, today is September 4th, and it's a Thursday. Let's take a look at the schedule on the right-hand side. Now, I'm going to turn the lights off in the front of the class right here, like that, so you can see better. All right, so today is the 4th. That's what it says on the schedule. Nice. So we're going to finish up chemistry chapter today. We are going to finish up chemistry chapter today. So I can talk louder than you guys. All right, so I tell you what, if you got to talk to each other about some important stuff, just step outside and then come back on in. Okay, so we're going to finish up chemistry chapter today and move into interactions between cells, which is chapter 6. But don't forget, you have your first test on a Tuesday. And when is that Tuesday? Not next week, not the week after, but the week after that, September 23rd. Okay, so you still have a lot of good time to look at the study guide. And if you have a question on what you should be studying for the lecture exam, it is clearly outlined for you in the study guide. All right, you got those exam figures, you got page numbers, you got questions. Oh, but there is a problem with questions in Blackboard. Okay, I got to look at that. I just remembered. End of chapter questions, those are all important things, right? Okay. Any questions on the syllabus right here, schedule? Yes. Right.
Is the test going to be on the entire chapter, or is
that? I would have you look at the study guide. It tells you the pages right there. Do you have the study guide right in front of you? No, that's okay. Maybe if we get down, I'll look at it, and the page numbers are very specific. It probably does not go into histology, but I think you guys know all that stuff already. Okay. All right, so another question. I don't see another question. Okay, let's go to the lecture. So you learned about different kinds of bonds, chemical bonds. You learned strong ones, covalent, weak ones that are ionic, even weaker ones, hydrogen. And there's some other forces that are even weaker than all of those three. And what was that? Kind of a funny one. Van der Waals force. Yes. All right. And all of these things have to do with valence electrons. Where do you find valence electrons? In the outermost shell, right? And you can use that periodic table to figure out where these electrons go in the various shells. And you know how many electrons an element has, because that also is shown you in the periodic table. The only thing you really have to know are the chemical symbols, the names of the chemical symbols. All right, so remember, sodium is strange. What's the symbol for sodium? It's Na, right. All right, so you got to learn those symbols. We looked so far at three major kinds of biological molecules. We started with carbohydrates, right? Then we went into lipids, and then we went into proteins, learned something about protein synthesis, right? And we know what the building blocks are for all of these important compounds. Like, for instance, the building block of a protein is what kind of thing? An amino acid. And how are amino acids joined together? What kind of reaction? Yeah, it's going to be a dehydration synthesis. When you make a polysaccharide from two monosaccharides, what kind of reaction is made? Or what kind of reaction is used in your body? Uh-oh, you guys got to start studying a lot or that exam's going to blow you away. Okay, it's going to be a dehydration synthesis reaction. Right, and how would you put a triglyceride onto a glycerol molecule? What kind of reaction would be used? Dehydration synthesis reaction. Yeah, please. And I think it's really helpful for you to answer these things out loud in class, because that activates so many more parts of your brain. It will help you remember. Right, so it's good for you to remember that. Okay, protein structure. I think we're done with protein structure, because we got as far, remember we talked about these van der Waals forces, and van der Waals forces, hydrogen bonds, even covalent bonds and ionic bonds stabilize the structure of a protein when it's made. We call that the conformation. And in order for this protein to do its job, guess what? It has to have a particular form, a particular shape. And if it if that shape changes, then what happens to the protein? The function changes. So it might go from an active protein to an inactive protein. Oh, I know what I was trying to do wrong. Here, do that. So I was trying to get my pointer to come back. Now it will just stay, alive right here. Good. All right, and we're going to do one and one. Right, and so all of these bonds will stabilize a protein so that it can exist under various conditions, but not change. But it won't work properly if the temperature is increased or decreased, or if the salt concentration goes beyond physiologic limits, or if the pH goes beyond physiologic limits, then the shape of this protein is going to change, and what do we call that? Denaturation, right? The shape changes, and now you know that the function changes, but as we were walking out the door, we also noticed that if you denatured a protein by heat, right, so it lost its function, you can't ever get that protein back just by cooling it down. As a matter of fact, there's only one circumstance that I know where a protein can be natured and then it can be renatured in its native form, right? And that's when somebody gets a perm in their hair, permanent in their hair. These disulfide bridges are broken, then somebody's hair is put in a certain kind of shape, and then the beautician can reform these disulfide bridges, and that can either curl hair up or straighten hair out or whatever, right? And I think if you can tolerate the chemistry on your head, you could do this repeatedly over and over and over again, okay? But as far as a hamburger or a steak, once you denature it, once you cook it, it's always going to be in that form, no matter what temperature it is. And I asked you to think about a particular case where a protein is denatured and then renatured back to its native or normal conformation. Could anybody think of an example besides having a permanent in your hair? Anybody, anybody, anybody? Okay. I'm interested to know. I should make that extra credit. There probably is not another example. Okay, so we were talking about the structure of a protein. It's determined by the sequence of amino acids, right? We call that the primary structure. And what does the primary structure determine? It determines the secondary structure, and we have two kinds of secondary structure, this alpha helix or a beta pleated sheet. You might have an illustration in your book with a beta pleated sheet, but it's going to be an accordion shape. It's going to have sharp edges coming back and forth instead of nice round smooth edges. And so that's the secondary structure. And the secondary structure is a building block for what? The tertiary structure. And the tertiary structure is the overall form that this protein takes, the overall conformation. And there might be special little pockets within this protein that can accept other kinds of groups that are not proteins, like this heme group. And so the structure of this protein is changed when the heme group is added to it. So what does that mean? The function of that protein changes. With the heme group, it's able to bind oxygen and deliver it in your body. Without this heme group, then this just becomes a protein that cannot deliver oxygen. All right, so again, change in structure causes a change in function. Sometimes different subunits of a protein can bind together to form what we call quaternary structure. All right, so this is the actual hemoglobin molecule that carries oxygen. And so you can see the four subunits. Hopefully it's in four different colors, but at least you can see what? You can see the four different heme groups on this particular molecule. So how many oxygens can hemoglobin carry? One in each of these locations, so it can carry four. So every molecule of hemoglobin can carry four oxygens around in your body. So this is what we call the quaternary structure. If proteins can join together, right, to form a stable complex, then that's what we call the quaternary structure. And what's the building block for quaternary structure? The tertiary structure, yeah. So the protein has to have the right tertiary structure. It has to have just the right shape so that all of these subunits can fit together. If it doesn't have the right shape, then these subunits will not come together, and then you won't have a hemoglobin molecule. All right, so that's pretty much it for hemoglobin, no, for proteins. One more slide. So proteins can be modified. They can be modified by conjugating it with a sugar molecule like glucose. And what kind of reaction would your body use to make a glycoprotein, a molecule that's part protein and part sugar? Would join those two molecules together. Dehydration synthesis reaction. Yeah. Okay. And lipoproteins will be a protein that can bind a lipid. So then it has both that lipid nature and a protein nature. What kind of reaction in your body would it use to make a lipoprotein? Dehydration synthesis reaction, right? And that not only would involve a lipid and a protein, but what other molecule would be involved in that reaction? So you have to look at that diagram. You really should have those diagrams in your mind. It is the water molecule, right? So a water molecule would come out of both this, one water would come out of the lipid and protein, right? And that would help form that covalent bond between the lipid and a protein through a dehydration synthesis reaction. Dehydration means that a water molecule comes out. All right, what's the reverse? How would you break down a glycoprotein, or how would you break down a lipoprotein? Hydrolysis. In that particular case, right, you start with a water molecule, it has to be broken down, and then the two parts, right, will end up in different parts of this molecule. One part will end up in the lipid, the other in the protein. That would be called a hydrolysis reaction. So, here we have a table of some important proteins that are found in the body. Okay, hemoglobin and myoglobin have to do with oxygen. They can bind oxygen. Hemoglobin is what's in our blood, and it delivers oxygen to the tissues. And remember, every molecule of hemoglobin can bind four because of its quaternary structure. Myoglobin is something very similar to hemoglobin. It has an iron group, and it doesn't form any kind of tertiary structure. It just is a single molecule by itself, and it can bind, right, one oxygen molecule, and it's for storing oxygen in your muscles. We'll find out why that is important, but it, just for me to get a sense of where you guys are at, why do you think a muscle needs oxygen? Why does a muscle need oxygen? Anybody have a guess? I think I heard a pretty good guess over here. Right, because we have an organelle in our cells called a mitochondria, and it needs oxygen to make ATP, which is the energy molecule in our body. So oxygen is important that way. Here is a hormone, insulin. We've talked about that. And we'll probably talk about some of these other compounds a little bit later in the class. All right, so that takes us to our fourth biological compound, and that is nucleic acids. Nucleic acids contain information, and in us, that information can be transmitted from one generation to another generation. And so that would be DNA. There are other kinds of nucleic acids, right? So DNA is one form, another form is RNA. All right, well, let's say what DNA really stands for. And you should probably write this down. It's not on this slide anywhere. It stands for deoxyribonucleic acid. Deoxyribonucleic acid. That's DNA. So when you hear that term, deoxy, you should see in that word that it's missing something. It's right? And we're going to look and see what it's missing. RNA, on the other hand, has just a regular ribose. That's a sugar. Deoxyribose is very similar. It's just missing one atom. Okay, and you could probably guess what atom that is. Deoxy, an oxygen atom, right? And so that's what makes the big difference between DNA and RNA, just that one oxygen atom and a big, long molecule that looks like that. So here is an example of a nucleotide, right? This is a nucleotide. Oh, it says right here. Nice. And we put a bunch of nucleotides together to get a nucleic acid. So what's the building block of DNA? Nucleotides. What's the building block of RNA? Nucleotides, right? A little bit different, but almost the same. And both DNA and RNA are what we call nucleic acids because they're made from nucleotides that look like this. There's some variation, but not nearly as much variation compared to amino acids. So what are some of the common features? Well, here is that sugar, a ribose sugar. I see five sides to it. So it's a five carbon sugar as opposed to a six carbon sugar that you're used to. And on one end of this five carbon sugar, it's either going to be a ribose or deoxyribose. There is a phosphate group. So here's a phosphate group on one end of the molecule. The other has a large organic base. So there are going to be a lot of hydrogens and carbons and some other compounds in here. And it's going to be, it's going to have a basic function. The phosphate group has an acidic function. And these nucleotides are joined together just like we see below here. Okay, and what kind of reaction would your body use to make a nucleic acid from these nucleotides? See, I just see a nucleotide here, but how many nucleotides do you see on the figure below? Yeah, there's four. What kind of reaction would your body use to make this nucleic acid from four nucleotides? It would be a dehydration synthesis reaction, something that you're really familiar with already because we've looked at it again and again and again. Okay, the differences between different nucleotides is that for DNA, there are four, only four of them. And you do have to be familiar with these. There's something called guanine, thymine, cytosine, and adenine. So we don't really see the chemical structure very well, but you might notice there's something different between guanine and thymine. What do you see on this slide? What's the difference right here? Yeah, I see a difference in size, right? So guanine is large, thymine is small. Right? Same thing. Cytosine here is small, adenine is large. We're going to use that information in just a second. All right, the other thing that I notice about this nucleic acid is that the bases do not bind together. They don't join together by chemical bonds, but the phosphate group joins all the ribose sugars together. Right, so it's always going to be a phosphate group, sugar, phosphate group, sugar, phosphate group, then what? Sugar, and then a phosphate group. So this forms that chain of nucleotides. Just like you have a chain of amino acids that makes a protein, here you have a chain of nucleotides that make this particular nucleic acid. And these are the four possible nucleotides that can be used to make DNA. Okay. And here they are here again. And this slide just kind of goes over what I've talked about already. You don't have to know which ones are in the purine family. You don't have to know which ones are in the pyrimidine family. Right? But you should know that some are small and some are large. Let's see why that is. Okay, because DNA does not exist in a single strand. It exists in a double strand. So here is one strand, there's going to be another strand over here, and they're going to come together. And so wherever you have a large nucleotide on one strand, guess what you have to have on the other so everything fits together? You have to have a small nucleotide. And where you have a small nucleotide, what do you have to have on the other strand? A large one, so that they fit together. And the bonds that join these molecules together, I see one here and here, this is a guanine, here is cytosine. Cytosine is small, guanine is large. The molecule fits together because these are hydrogen bonds. Right? So not only does it have the right shape, but it has these hydrogen bonds located at that specific location, specific orientation, so that they can form easily. And so guanine, cytosine form three hydrogen bonds, thymine only two. But again, thymine is a small molecule, adenine is large, so it fits together just right. So what kind of bonds are these hydrogen bonds? Are they strong or are they weak?
Weak.
They're weak, that's right. All right, so these bonds are easily put together, they're easily taken apart. Now what about the bonds between the phosphorus and the sugar, the ribose sugar?
Strong.
Strong, that's a covalent bond, right? Between this phosphorus and the sugar below, that's a covalent bond. So the bonds that hold the strands together, all right, as a strand, are very strong, but the bonds that hold two strands together in our bodies are weak because they're just hydrogen bonds. The other thing that you see on this particular slide is that only certain bases will pair up with each other, not just because of shape, but because of the number of hydrogen bonds. Guanine always will pair up with cytosine, and no other kind of nucleotide. Thymine will always pair up with adenine. So I see the what we call base pair rules. Right, so the two strands are not identical when you go from the top to the bottom. Right, they're going to be complementary to each other by shape. So here is a really good example of a DNA. How many strands do you see on this illustration? How many strands do you see? I see one here, and I see one here. To the outside of this molecule, you have the you have phosphate sugar, phosphate sugar, phosphate sugar, and then on the interior of the DNA molecule, what do you have?
Hydrogen.
You have these bases. So the bases stick into the center, right, and the sugar and phosphate are on the exterior, and in real life, it forms this nice helix, right? We call this a double helix. And so to the inside, you see the base pairs. On the outside, you just see the sugar and phosphate. So one way to think of a DNA molecule as a step ladder. Then the rungs of that step ladder, or the steps that you step on, are the bases. And what are the rails that you hold on to as you go up the ladder? It is the sugar phosphate backbone. Okay, and it's always going to be like that. But in real life, right, it's twisted together. And of course, you should know the base pairing rules. Cytosine will always pair with guanine, right? Thymine will always base pair with adenine. And that's specific for DNA. The other thing that's specific for DNA is that it will always be found in a double strand form, right? You won't ever find a single strand, only under certain circumstances. Okay, so let's look at another kind of nucleotide, right? And that is the ribose, and let's compare it with a deoxyribose. So what kind of nucleic acid does deoxyribose make? DNA or RNA?
DNA.
DNA. All right, so here is just a ribose sugar, and it's missing an oxygen. Here is a regular ribose sugar that has an OH group, so it has the oxygen. So does this look like a big change in structure? Deoxyribose and ribose. Does that look like a huge change in structure? It never impressed me as being a big change, right? Just because of that one oxygen atom. But that completely changes whether it is a DNA nucleotide or an RNA nucleotide. So what this shows you is that small changes in structure can mean what? Large changes in function, which is sort of interesting. Okay. So we have the different riboses. And in RNA, there is one other substitution. Not only do we get ribose, but we get a different kind of base, and that is uracil. And that's going to replace thymine. Thymine is the nucleotide that we're going to see in DNA. We're never going to see thymine in RNA. We're going to see a compound called uracil. But what can you tell me about the shape of thymine and uracil? Is one big and one large? No, they both basically have the same kind of shape. Again, they're just a small change in structure, and that's going to make all the difference in the world between DNA and RNA. The other thing that we will notice in RNA is that it exists in a single strand. Right? So different RNA nucleotides will be put together. Oh, what kind of reaction would be used when you add nucleotides together? Dehydration synthesis reaction, right? It will make a long strand of RNA, but it won't base pair with another RNA molecule in most circumstances. So what kind of nucleic acids are there? Well, there are three main kinds that are made inside the nucleus, right? Messenger, transfer, and ribosomal RNA. Ribosomal RNA is used to make a ribosome. And I think from anatomy, you should remember, what's the function of a ribosome? It's got a special function. It is an organelle inside the cell. What on earth does it do? It makes proteins. This is the workbench where amino acids are joined together. Right, so that's ribosomal RNA. The workbench, or ribosomal RNA, or a ribosome, needs amino acids in order to make a protein. And it's the job of the next RNA molecule to bring amino acids to a ribosome, and that is the transfer RNA. transfer RNA wanders around inside the cell looking for a particular amino acid, and then it drags it over to a ribosome so that it can be used to make a protein. All right, what did I call that in anatomy, which is kind of a misnomer? I don't want you to really say this to anybody else except me. What's another way of thinking about transfer RNA? Anybody remember? You could think of it as a taxi RNA, right? So it's bringing amino acids over to the ribosome. Well, in order for a protein to have the correct shape, it's got to have the correct amino acids in a particular sequence. Just like when you spell a word, it has to have the correct spelling. So you could think of nucleotides as being like letters that you make up a word. So in order to have a certain word, you have to know the order of letters to make it up, right? Because if you change the order of letters in a word, what do you do to the word? You change it. And a lot of times it will just be nonsense. The same thing will happen to proteins in your body. So the dictionary that tells a ribosome how to join amino acids together is what we call messenger RNA. Messenger RNA is similar to a protein because it's just a really long sequence of building blocks put together. So for the long sequence of building blocks in a protein, what are the building blocks? Amino acids. One amino acid joined to another, joined to another, joined to another. And in messenger RNA, what is the building block? Building block for a nucleic acid is a nucleotide. Right, so it's different than an amino acid. And you know four different kinds of nucleotides, they have to be joined together in just the right sequence in order to spell out a protein through that process that we call protein synthesis. So that information is contained in the messenger RNA. This is always made inside the nucleus. Right, and this RNA is made from DNA. And where do we always find DNA? Where do we always find DNA in our cells? In the nucleus. It's inside the nucleus. Yeah, DNA is very important. It's protected behind the nuclear envelope. And RNA is like a copy of the information in DNA. And that information is then transported into the cytoplasm. And there it can be destroyed by accident, or it can be used to make a protein. But for instance, if that RNA in the cytoplasm is destroyed, will that cause the death of the cell? Is that a really terrible thing? And the answer is no, because that information is still in the nucleus in the form of DNA, so the cell can go back to that DNA and make more RNA molecules. It can replace those that are damaged or lost. So that's the reason why DNA is always in the nucleus and RNA goes into the cytoplasm for the second step of protein synthesis. All right, so this was a lot of like anatomy, right? Chemistry that we just talked about is a lot of anatomy. We looked at some ways that chemicals can come together. That's sort of more like physiology, but I do want you to know the different anatomy of these molecules, because we're going to talk about how they function inside the cell. And I guess maybe there's just one other thing that I want to say about protein synthesis, and I have some other slides real soon, but I want you to be thinking of these things. All right, so you know a protein is one of the four general kinds of biological molecules you have in your body, which are what? Carbohydrates, lipids, proteins, and nucleic acids. Right? And the building block of a nucleic acid is a nucleotide, right? And there's two major kinds of nucleotides. There's deoxyribo that we see right here, deoxyribonucleotide, or it can be a ribonucleotide if that oxygen is right here in this location. What else did I want to say? Okay. So DNA is always found in the nucleus. Protein synthesis, does anybody know how many steps does it take to make a protein from a nucleic acid? Because remember that messenger RNA contains the information how to make that protein. The workbench is in the cytoplasm, the ribosomal RNA, and then the ribosome also has the amino acids because you have the transfer RNA, bringing amino acids to the ribosome. All right, but when a protein is made, how many step process is it? Okay, I hear 3 and 2, that's pretty good. And maybe I'm asking the question a little bit hard to understand, but there are 2 main processes that are necessary to make a protein. All right, and the first step happens inside the nucleus where information in DNA is converted into RNA. What's the building block of DNA?
Nucleotide.
A nucleotide. What's the building block of RNA?
Nucleotide.
Right? So it's the same language. DNA and RNA are made out of the same letters, mostly. Right? Just that little change. Right? So the RNA is almost an exact copy of DNA inside the nucleus. If I would like to, or if you would like to, make an exact copy of all your work that you've done at a particular college with the grades and what semester you took it, because maybe you needed to hand that to your employer, or maybe you're going to graduate and go to another college, right? What would that college ask you for, and what would you give them?
Transcript.
A transcript. And tell me something about that transcript. Is it any different than the one that's in admission and records?
No,
it's going to be exactly the same. It's going to be what? A photocopy, right? It's going to be a photocopy of the information that admissions and records has, and then you could take that transcript and send it to wherever you wanted. But say somebody gave it to you and you were going to send it somewhere else, but then you lost it, so you couldn't send it to another college. Would that be terrible? Would all your records be lost forever? No, because you could just go to admission and records and ask for another transcript. Right, so this first step in protein synthesis is what we call transcription, and that's the conversion of DNA into RNA. They're basically the same language. So RNA, maybe you should think of as a photocopy of DNA. It's just a duplicate of RNA of DNA. So, and if this RNA is damaged, the cell still can stay alive because that information still is in DNA. Now, where do we always find DNA? You answered this not too long ago. In the nucleus. So where does that process of converting information from DNA to RNA take place?
Nucleus,
because DNA never leaves the nucleus, right? So that first step of protein synthesis is transcription, and that happens inside the nucleus for that reason. All right, but we want to get to a protein. So we're at the RNA stage right now. All right, so what happens here, that information in RNA is used to make a protein, and you know what the building block of a protein is, that's an amino acid. So information in messenger RNA is used to take amino acids in the proper sequence to make a properly shaped protein. Now, what's the building block of an RNA once again? It's a nucleotide. What's the building block of protein? Amino acid. They're different, right? They're different. So the language of a nucleic acid is a nucleotide. The language of protein is amino acid. So what do you call that process where you convert one language into another?
Translation.
Right? So that's the second step in protein synthesis, right? You change from Spanish to English, Farsi to Hindi, Tagalog to, I don't know, Mandarin. That's a process called translation. Now, what about the information in one language compared to the other? Should the information be the same?
Yes.
Yeah, it should be the same. Shouldn't lose information. Just the language changes. The same thing when RNA, when the information in RNA is converted into information in a protein. Right? It's still there. It's just in a different form. So that second step is called translation. And that happens in the cytoplasm. Right, because this RNA can actually leave the nucleus and go into the cytoplasm. So transcription in the nucleus, that's step number one. Step number two, translation, happens in the cytoplasm because that's where all the ribosomes are located, right, in the cytoplasm. All right, so that's some of the basic chemistry that I wanted you to see. And now I want you to become familiar with some of these structures. And I'm sure I have a video of this. Yeah, you do. Okay.
So,
I'm glad. That's good.
We talk about these 3 steps that happen inside the nucleus, right?
First step. First of 2 for protein synthesis. Is that what you're referring to, protein synthesis?
No, I'm confused because because the last one you talk about it, the transfer to the RNA, that happened on the cytosome. But we just talked before, these things happen inside the nucleus.
Making RNA happens inside the nucleus. But there are no amino acids inside the nucleus. So the transfer RNA can't get an amino acid inside the nucleus. It has to go into the cytoplasm. And there it's going to look for amino acids. When it finds the proper one, it's going to grab it and bring it to the workbench to make a protein. What kind of RNA is used to make that workbench to make a protein? Yeah, the ribosomal RNA. Right? That's where proteins are made, on the ribosome. Okay, we're going to go over this again in a chapter coming up real soon, maybe even before the first test. So this is just some introduction to the material that we call protein synthesis. Just remember two steps. They're going to be in different locations. They got different names. But think of it in terms of information. The information in a protein, right, is the same as the information inside RNA, which is the same as the information in DNA. All right, so I got a slide right here. And it's just a square. This represents just a little station where you can rest and not really think about anything. All right, so let's go to the next slide to see what's there. All right, so what is this chemical right here? What is this chemical? Okay, it is a nucleotide. Because here is a ribose sugar, here is the base, looks like that, and then here is the phosphate group. So this is the building block of either DNA or RNA. This is a nucleotide. And you don't have to tell me what base this is. But look at this position right here. It's highlighted. I see an OH, not an H. So is this a deoxyribonucleotide or a ribonucleotide? Is it deoxy? Yeah, it's a ribonucleotide. Because of this oxygen right here. This is the kind of nucleotide that's used to make RNA, right? Ribonucleic acid, not DNA, not deoxyribonucleic acid. All right, so we're going to come back. What are the three parts of this nucleotide? Phosphate, sugar, base, organic base. Okay. All right, then you get to rest a little bit, but we're going to move on. Okay, what kind of functional group do you see here highlighted? That is a sulfhydryl group. And in that protein that you saw earlier, this group can be used to stabilize the shape of a protein because it can form a covalent bond to some other part of that protein as it's being made. So sulfhydryl group. And then a rest station. But we're not tired. So what group is this? That is an amino group. This is an amino group. Rest station. What is this one here? That is a carboxyl group. Carboxyl group. And what is this one here? They have all these groups. That might be your favorite. That's a phosphate group because there's a phosphate that has these hydrogens here that can jump off and form an ion. And when they jump off, that donates protons to that solution. So it is also acidic, right? Because that's the definition of what an acid is. It donates protons to a solution. What is this? Rest station. Okay. Now, what is this right here? I see 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. And on every carbon, there's a water molecule. This is a carbohydrate. Right? So I do want you to tell me that this is a carbohydrate. And it can form a ring that we see over here. So when you see this ring structure just like that, you should see that as a carbohydrate. And it's a particular kind. This is what we call a simple sugar or a monosaccharide. These monosaccharides can be joined together to form a disaccharide. With what kind of reaction? Dehydration synthesis. You don't have to tell me if this is glucose or fructose, galactose, or any other kind of os, right? But just tell me that it is a carbohydrate, and monosaccharide would be a really good answer. Rest station. What's this thing here? Is this a sugar? It is not a sugar. It is just a long hydrocarbon chain, right, with a carboxyl group on the end. And what kind of group is that? That's acidic. So this is some kind of acid. Yeah. This right here, right, that long hydrocarbon chain, all of these are nonpolar bonds. So this molecule right here is a fat, a lipid, right? And so here's the acid part, here's the fatty part. That is a fatty acid, but you should also recognize what kind of fatty acid is that. Don't tell me the name. I would like to know. It's a saturated fatty acid. No double bonds anywhere in here, right? Okay. Next. Rest. That's good. Oh, wow, what's going on here? We could talk a little bit about this. Could talk a long time, but I don't want to spend a lot of time. What is this thing here that I'm circling? That's a fatty acid, right? Here's a carboxyl group. Here's that long hydrocarbon chain. How many do you see? I see three. And here is a different kind of molecule. I see it has three OHs. It has three carbons. You got to memorize what this thing is. This is glycerol, right? So here's glycerol. We haven't looked at any other three-carbon molecules, so the only one you really have to know is glycerol. And then these fatty acids can be joined to this glycerol, these three fatty acids, with what kind of reaction?
Dehydration
synthesis. So three waters come out, and now you've got this beast over here, which is a triglyceride. If you want to break a triglyceride down, what kind of reaction would your body use? Hydrolysis, right? So this water molecule would break apart. Different parts of it would go to the fatty acid or glycerol. All right, so be familiar with this diagram right here. Be able to name its parts. Now you need a rest station because that was a lot. But let's move on. Here is what? Monosaccharide, right? It's just a long hydrocarbon. For every carbon, there's a water molecule, and it can form a ring structure, a little bit different because it has a little bit different form. All right, so here is a monosaccharide. What is a monosaccharide a building block of? A polysaccharide. Polysaccharide. And a polysaccharide is a sugar. Okay, so you are right. But maybe mono, then di, poly. That would be a good way to think of it. Wow, what's going on here? What's the name for this thing? This is a micelle. What are the building blocks of a micelle? I see one right here. That is a phospholipid. Here's the phosphate end. Here is the lipid end. So this is a magic molecule. Why? Because it can dissolve in. It can dissolve in water, but it can also dissolve in lipid oil. Right. So here is the polar end that can dissolve in water. Here's the nonpolar. I'm sorry. Here's the polar end that can dissolve in water. Here's the nonpolar end that will dissolve in only nonpolar solvents, okay, or things that have that like nature, which are other nonpolar compounds, like these little tails coming off the phosphate group. So here is a phospholipid, okay, and it is forming a micelle because these lipid parts don't want to associate with water. They are what do we call something that does not want to associate with water because they are nonpolar. They are not associating with water, they are hydrophobic, right? The parts that are polar that like to associate with water are hydrophilic, right? Either loving or hating water just because of their basic physical chemistry, which you know a lot about now, like how to form ions and all that kind of stuff. And what do you see right here? You don't have to tell me the specific names, but give me generally what we have. Steroids. And where does steroid fit in terms of carbohydrates, proteins, lipids, and nucleic acids?
Lipid.
It's a kind of lipid. Yeah, these are all hydrocarbons right here. So these are steroids, and maybe you could remember this top one actually is cholesterol. It's an important precursor to these other hormones that we see on this page. All right, what do we got right here? Here is an acid. Here's the fatty part. So here's a fatty acid, but you should know what kind. Unsaturated fatty acid, because I see double bonds. Unsaturated means that at this location there's not a hydrogen, so it's unsaturated. At this location, no hydrogen because of this double bond. Unsaturated fatty acid, rest station. What's this one right here? Let's take a look at this. What's this group? Amino group. What's this group here? Yeah, that's the carboxylic group, but it is, you could also think of this as an acid. So what kind of compound has an amino group and an acid group? Amino acid, right? So, oh, there it is. It's written out for you right there. Here is an amino acid. This R just means that there can be a lot of variability of what kinds of compounds will bind to this central carbon. All right, what do we got right here? I see three carbons in a row, and then on the top I see two fatty acids joined, and then on this third carbon I see a phosphorus, and I see a negative charge, right, and I see this phosphatidyl group right here. You don't have to know that, but here I see a lot of electrical charges, which means that this is a polar compound in this area, right? So this area likes to associate with water. It's hydrophilic. But what about these hydrocarbons up over here? They don't like to associate with water. They are hydrophobic. So this is a really nice diagram of a phospholipid. Yeah, phospholipid. And phospholipids are hugely important for structural reasons because they make membranes. It's the basic building block of membranes in our body. They have some other functions that we'll look at, but they make membranes. And we got a lot of membranes in our body. Instead of drawing all of this out, if I ask you to draw a phospholipid, you could draw this out, and of course that would be correct, but what would be another way? Like this right here, right? A circle with these two legs coming out. The circle is the hydrophilic part. These little legs are the hydrophobic part. So it has those two natures, phospholipid. Next one. What's here? This is actually pretty easy the way I have these slides together because all these molecules are kind of similar to the one before it and after it. So what's this? Is this carbohydrate, protein, lipid, or nucleic acid? It's a lipid. And here's that carboxyl group. Here's a long hydrocarbon chain. Kind of looks like a fatty acid, but it's bent back on itself. These are what we call prostaglandins. Prostaglandins come from fatty acids in our body. So if you want, say you want two fatty acids to make some prostaglandins right here, where would you find two fatty acids? In a phospholipid molecule, because phospholipid has two fatty acids. Right? So even membranes can be used to make some of these prostaglandins. That's sort of interesting. Okay. What do we see right here? Let's say that this is a protein, not DNA. What kind of structure do we see? Secondary structure. And what's the building block for this secondary structure? Primary structure, just a sequence of amino acids, right? And the secondary structure is the building block for tertiary structure. Okay. All right. What do we got right here? Phosphate, sugar, organic base. Missing oxygen. This is a nucleotide, in particular a deoxyribonucleotide, right? See, deoxyribonucleotide. All right. Okay, what group is this? Hydroxyl group. All right, what molecule is this? This is? Okay, three carbons, OH on each of these locations right here. I do want you to know this one, this is glycerol. This is a building block of what kind of molecule? Triglyceride, yeah. Building block of triglyceride. What group is this? That's a carbonyl. And what do we got right here? This is just a regular old ribose. So this is a ribonucleotide, right? Phosphate, sugar, organic base. Oxygen here, ribonucleic acid. All right, so I want to go over these just a little bit faster. The more you see them, the more you're going to become familiar with them. In Blackboard, there's a video where I go through these kind of slow, and then I do it fast the second time, and even faster maybe the third time. I think I go through it three times. That's just a little speed test for you. All right, so you can go over all these chemicals really fast. You could go over them probably how many times? Probably 10 times, maybe even 20 times in 1 minute. All right, so we won't go that fast right now. All right, so this one right here is a ribonucleic acid. What do we got here? Sulfhydryl. What do we got here? Amino. Then take a breath so you don't pass out. And then what's here? Carboxyl group. What can you tell me about a carboxyl group? Is it basic or acidic? Yeah, it's acidic, so it's not neutral, it's not basic, it is acidic. What's this right here? Phosphate group, that's also acidic. And here is a monosaccharide. Here is a saturated fatty acid. Saturated fatty acid. And what's happening here? Dehydration synthesis reaction with, what are the building blocks? Three fatty acids and one glycerol molecule. Yeah. Forming a triglyceride. All right. What's here? Monosaccharide. Here is a? Okay. Here, the building block is phospholipid. That was going to be my next question. These building blocks, the phospholipids, come together to make a micelle, right? And do you need any special machinery to make this structure happen? No, forms automatically, right? So micelle. What's here?
Steroids.
What's here? That is an unsaturated fatty acid because why? It's missing. There are double bonds in here. And these double bonds will bring different kinds of bending patterns. They're not just straight, but they make the fatty acid bend in a different way, and that means that the structure of that fatty acid changes. So that means that the function will change as well. What do we got here? Amino acid. And here, that's phospholipid. That might be your favorite molecule right now in this class. What is this? These are prostaglandins. Here is, tell me what kind of structure this is.
Secondary
structure. You should know what the building block of secondary structure is and why you need secondary structure. Why do you need secondary structure? Because you need that to have the proper tertiary structure of a protein. It's got to have the proper shape. All right, what's this one here? Phosphate, sugar, organic base. This is missing oxygen. This is a deoxyribonucleotide, right? Nucleotide building block for RNA and DNA. And in particular, this one right here, is it a building block for DNA or RNA?
DNA,
because it's what? Deoxy, right? And here's deoxy. Cool. What do we got here? Hydroxyl group, rest. Then here is glycerol. Here is carbonyl. What's this? It's a nucleotide. This is a ribo, just a plain old ribose sugar. Ribonucleotide found in what kind of molecule? RNA. Here is sulfhydryl, amino, carboxyl group. That's acidic as well. Phosphate. Monosaccharide, saturated fatty acid. Oh, we did this already. Okay. Yeah, triglyceride formed by dehydration synthesis reaction with three fatty acids and one, what is this one here? Glycerol. All right. So we've gone over it a couple of times. Let's speed it up just a little bit. Let's spend maybe another minute on this before I go to the next chapter. All right, so are you ready? Don't blink. All right, so what do we got right there? Monosaccharide. What is this right here? That's a micelle. What do we see right there?
Steroids.
What do we got there? Unsaturated fatty acid. Unsaturated fatty acid. Here is an amino acid. Here is a phospholipid. Here we have prostaglandins. And here we have secondary structure of a protein. Here we have deoxyribonucleotide. That is a hydroxyl group. The molecule is glycerol. Then we have carbonyl group. What is that? That would be a ribonucleotide, right? Let's go back. Ribonucleotide, because it has the oxygen. It's not deoxy. Right, that's just a ribonucleotide. And I think we're really close to the end. That's a sulfhydryl group, amino group, carboxyl group, phosphate group, monosaccharide. I think we're done. What was that? That was pretty fast. Maybe I didn't see it. Probably a saturated fatty acid. Yes, it was. Okay, so you can just check yourself to make sure that you understand the structure of these different compounds. These are in your study guide for the test. And you have that video with this flash quiz that you can just practice. And You know, it's a digital file, so you can hop from one part of the video to another if you want. Okay. So I do want you to be able to recognize those compounds on a test. So I'm going to close that down. All right, so help me out. What's the next chapter going to be? And genetic control. Okay. Yeah, what chapter is that? Three? Indeed it is. All right, let me get my arrow back. Part of this chapter is just a review of anatomy, right? But in anatomy, maybe you learned what the structure of a mitochondria is. Probably you all did that. And maybe some of you learned what the function of that mitochondria is in anatomy, but in physiology, for sure, we got to know these things. All right, so these are the things that we're going to look at, starting with the plasma membrane. And here I see a nice picture of a cell. And we like to understand building blocks in this particular case, like building blocks of a triglyceride, building block of a DNA. Yeah, question. Oh, I would rather do six next. Okay, so I'm going to put this away. Somebody told me, I didn't check. Okay, let's check. What is next? Chapter 6, interactions between cells and their environment. Okay, so notes for 6. Here it is right here. All right. Okay, so our bodies are made up of cells, and there are spaces between these cells. And the space between cells is what we call the extracellular environment. All the space inside the cell we would call the intracellular environment. And they're all in our body, for sure. Inside the cell is alive. And the extracellular environment just might store water for us or electrolytes. Can you give me an example of an electrolyte? Something that has an electrical charge on it. It's got to be an ion. Yeah, calcium is a good example. Sodium is a good example. Phosphorus, potassium, chloride. Okay. So all those things can dissolve in water. And we have a lot of water inside cells and outside as well. The intracellular compartment is 67% of your total body, okay, is water in that intracellular compartment. The extracellular compartment, we're just going to call that ECF, right, 33% is outside of cells. So only 67% of you is inside of a cell, 33% is outside of a cell. If we think of all that material that's outside of a cell, all right, let's think of everything outside the cell as being 100% of something. 80% of that extracellular fluid is what we call interstitial fluid. It's contained in a jelly-like material that absorbs water. It's like a sponge. It's a matrix. So you can almost think of it as like a connective tissue, right? Because in a connective tissue, you have a lot of spaces between cells. And then the other compartment in the extracellular place is the fluid part that's in blood. So 80% is between cells. 20% is inside our cardiovascular system. It's the fluid part of blood. And remember, blood has two parts. It's got a cellular part and it's got a fluid part. We're going to look at that in a lot of detail in this class. And so the cellular part has cells like red blood cells, white blood cells. What do we call the fluid part of blood? It's got a specific name. It is called plasma, right? So 20% of all extracellular fluid is that fluid in our circulatory system, and we call that plasma. Right? But most of it, most of the extracellular fluid is in that space between cells, which we call interstitial fluid. And that's important because things can move around in a fluid. Things cannot move around in a solid. If something's in a solid, then it's kind of glued in a position. But if it's in a fluid, like gas, right, that we're breathing, or this liquid right here, plasma, then substances can move around. So here is, what are we looking at right here? I see a surface. Remember what kind of tissue covers a surface? That's an epithelium, right? And right below the epithelium is a basement membrane. And the basement membrane connects the epithelium, which is covering the surface, with a connective tissue. And a connective tissue then connects the epithelium to other underlying structures, like blood vessels, for instance, or bones or muscles. Right? So let's consider this connective tissue that's below the basement membrane. And it has fibers in it, but it also has ground substance. And that ground substance acts like that sponge that can absorb water, and things can move around through that water. These things, these filaments that connect the cells together, that give, that hold the basement membrane to the connective tissue, but also give shape to this part of your body, these are what we call integrins. Integrins are these proteins that actually embed themselves into the plasma membrane of a cell, the cell membrane. So that's what we see right here. I see a couple arrows, which means that this fluid, the water part of blood, can actually move out of this blood vessel into this connective tissue, and then even move into these cells right over here, because it all has a water environment. Now, what kind of blood vessel does this look like to you? Okay, I see this arrow right here. That's really a clue. Okay, and it is a capillary, because only a capillary allows for exchange. Exchange always happens in a capillary, and the reason why is because a capillary is the only blood vessel that has just a simple epithelium that makes up its wall, right? And, but we call it an endothelium. It's just a simple squamous epithelium. All right, so diffusion happens in capillaries. So we're interested in how things move around in the body, and in particular, how they move across the plasma membrane. So the plasma membrane on a cell is selectively permeable. It allows some things to move across it, but not everything. The cell takes up things that it needs, and transports it across the membrane, and it kicks out stuff that it doesn't need, again, across the plasma membrane. So many important molecules have transporters or channels. And the reason why that is because these molecules can't move across the membrane all by themselves. Can you tell me what the building block of a membrane is once again? Phospholipid, yeah. And it's two layers of phospholipids. And the inside of that membrane is lipid. So things that are polar cannot diffuse across that membrane because the inner part is a lipid. So water can't diffuse across the membrane. Sodium and potassium, which are ions, can't move across the membrane. Glucose, which has all those polar covalent bonds, can't move across the membrane all by itself. These molecules have to have either channels or transporters that allow materials to move into the cell or out of the cell. Okay. Some of these might involve energy, and then we call that an active transport process. But if it moves by diffusion from high concentration to low, right, then that's what we call a passive process. Right? And passive processes that work by diffusion can move across the membrane via channels as opposed to transporter type mechanisms. Right, so we got passive and active. Passive does not require energy. And what can you tell me about active transport?
Requires
energy. Right, and one of the familiar energy molecules, or very common energy molecule in your body, is ATP. A lot of active transport molecules require ATP, will hydrolyze ATP. And what does hydrolyze mean? Put together or break apart? Take a big molecule and hydrolyze, what happens? If you break it down into smaller pieces. So what happens to ATP? It gets broken down to ADP and an inorganic phosphate. All right, so a passive process is something that just happens automatically. does not need ATP. But things can only go in one direction. Things can only move from high concentration to low concentration. That is diffusion, requires no energy. So in the room, if you look around, do you see a fan on or anything? Is there a fan? I don't see a fan. The heat air conditioner doesn't even look like it's on. There's no currents of air in the room right here. And let's just say I have a nice perfume bottle and I open up the cap of the perfume bottle, some of it's going to evaporate into the air and then I can smell it with my nose. Right? But what's going to happen to that perfume that's in the air right around me by the perfume bottle? Sooner or later, somebody in the front row is going to smell it. And then after that, somebody in the second row. And then after that, somebody in the third row. So that perfume molecule will move around inside the room, right, moving from high concentration near the bottle to low concentration or even zero concentration that's in the back of the room, right? So if I leave that perfume bottle open all weekend when we're not here, close the doors, will the people in the back be able to smell the perfume when they came in on Tuesday? They can, right? Because by diffusion, that molecule has moved from high concentration to low. Right? And then after a long time, like over a weekend, let's just say the concentration is the same in the back of the room compared to the front of the room, what happens to diffusion then? When there is no concentration difference, then diffusion stops, right? So diffusion needs a gradient in order for it to happen. And things can only move, how do things move? By passive transport from high concentration to low concentration. Active transport, on the other hand, can take something from low concentration and put it into a place where there's high concentration, like lifting it up, right? And that requires energy. Most times, what kind of energy is used? ATP, right? Okay. So if something moves from low concentration to high concentration, right? From low concentration to high concentration, is that diffusion?
No.
From low to high?
No.
It's an active transport. Things have to go from high to low in order for it to be diffusion. All right, so let's define what a solution is. I don't do this in anatomy. Maybe you guys know some of this stuff already, but a solution has two major parts to it, right? It has the solvent part, that's the liquid part, and then it's got the solute part. So things that can dissolve in that liquid will be the solute. So let's pick a solvent. A really good solvent for this class is going to be water. All right, so that's the solvent in a solution. Now, what would be a solute?
Sugar.
Yeah, sugar, salt. These are things that you could take in a solid form, put in water, and they'll dissolve. Right? So that would be the solute. So then you would have a solution. And what is the solvent that we were just talking about?
Water.
Water is the solvent. Solutes are these other particles that we put into it. All right, what have you used as a solvent today? What have you used as a solvent? Just this part right here. Not the solution, but just this part right here.
Water.
Yeah. Has anybody used any other kind of solvent? That's probably a good thing. Most other kinds of solvents are kind of dangerous. So that's good. All right, so you used water. What kind of solutes have you used today?
Sugar.
You poured that maybe in this water solvent, right? And then if you were to take water and put sugar in it, what would you end up with? Yeah, water and sugar together, you would get a solution, right? Because you have both a solvent and solute together, that is a solution. What's the major solvent in your body?
Water.
Water, right? That's what we're dissolved in. What are some important molecules, what are some important solutes in your body? You could even say sugar once again, but maybe you would want to say some proteins.
ATP.
Okay, ATP is an important solute, sodium, potassium, all of those important things. And they have to be in the right proper concentration in order to maintain what? Homeostasis, right? So this solution has to have just the right amount of solvent and just the right of solute to maintain homeostasis. Here's kind of a tricky question. What's a minor solvent in your body? So you got water that you're mostly dissolved in. But you're also dissolved in another part, and it's a very minor part, but it plays a key role sometimes. And that is, so you got a polar compound, water, and then you have a nonpolar compound, fat. Okay, so oils are a minor solvent in your body, and nonpolar compounds can dissolve in that compartment. Maybe some vitamins, for instance. And that those molecules can also participate in chemical reactions. All right, what can dissolve in a minor solvent? Oh, in this minor solvent. We said it's oil. What can dissolve in this minor solvent? Cholesterol, because it is nonpolar, right? Any kind of polar molecule can dissolve in that solvent. And give an example. Well, okay. What can dissolve in a minor solvent? The minor solvent is nonpolar. So anything that is nonpolar can dissolve in it. And the example that somebody gave would be cholesterol, because it's a lipid, right? So it can dissolve in that component right there. All right, so let's pay a little bit closer attention to diffusion. Right, diffusion is a random motion of molecules. When there is a molecule, right, it is not just sitting still. It is always vibrating. It has some energy associated with it. It could be flexing or twisting. And as a matter of fact, temperature is just a measure of molecular motion. And as the temperature of something increases, then that motion gets faster, more exaggerated. As the molecule slows down, then the temperature gets cooler, right? And we can actually perceive that because we have thermoreceptors. So when you look at this particle right here on the slide, remember that it's actually vibrating around and it's moving around. Okay, it's just not sitting there. So diffusion is what we call the net movement of some kind of molecule from a region of high concentration to low, high to low. So here we have a beaker, and it's got a partition between two sides. And over here, I see a molecule, and I see lots of them for every little bit of surface area, right? If we were to count all these little dots on this side, we would count a lot of them. And if we look on the right-hand side, there are fewer, right? So what can you tell me about the concentration of these dots on the right-hand side compared to the left? Yeah, it's lower, right? And it's even labeled as such. So, and if we were to take this barrier away, guess what would happen? Molecules in this high concentration would move over here to the right, and you wouldn't have to stir the solution up or anything. That would just automatically happen because all of these molecules have a little bit of motion to them. Right, so that's what we would call diffusion, from high concentration to low. And then after a long period of time, what do we have? We have, to me it looks like there's equal concentration of these particles on the right and on the left. And then what can you tell me about diffusion? It stops, right? Actually, some molecules will move to the left, some will move to the right, but for every one that moves to the left, there's one that moves to the right, so they cancel each other out, so the concentration doesn't change. All right, so is this an active or passive process? That's a passive process, does not require energy. Things moving from high to low concentration. All right, so nonpolar compounds can diffuse through a cell membrane because a cell membrane is a lipid. Polar compounds can diffuse through it. And some small molecules like carbon dioxide and water. So let's look at this slide right here and think about gas exchange in our body. So here's our body. It's represented as a cell. Here's our body over here, right? A cell. And we have oxygen, and it's probably represented by this, is this blue? Little blue molecule? Light blue, dark blue? Okay. Oxygen is this little light blue molecule. Where is it at a high concentration? Okay, outside the cell or inside the cell? It's outside. And that's really fortunate because this cell needs oxygen, and oxygen can diffuse in. Why can the oxygen diffuse in? Because oxygen is low inside the cell. That's maybe strange to think about it like that. Where would you find high oxygen? Outside the cell or inside the cell? Remember, cells need oxygen. Oxygen is high outside. It's low inside, so oxygen will diffuse inside of the cell, and the cell needs oxygen. Right, mitochondria use that oxygen to make ATP for us, and in the process, it produces carbon dioxide. Now we want to get rid of that because that's a toxic compound. So where would we have high carbon dioxide? In the air or inside the cell?
Inside.
It's inside the cell. So carbon dioxide, represented by these little gold molecules right here, is high concentration inside the cell, low in the air. It's almost zero in the air. So there is a big concentration gradient for carbon dioxide. So carbon dioxide is very ready and willing to leave your body just because of that concentration gradient. Right, so that's how diffusion works. So what we have right here is a membrane, right? And the building block of a membrane is this phospholipid. The basic way we think of a membrane is a phospholipid bilayer. A better way to think of a membrane is with the fluid mosaic model. The phospholipid membrane is very fluid, but what changes the function of a membrane is that the cell can insert certain kinds of proteins into the membrane, all different kinds of proteins, and that's the mosaic part of the fluid mosaic model that we use to think about a cell membrane. All right, so here we have intracellular space. On the right, we have extracellular space, and we've got some particles, and they're just called ions. So what can you tell me about these particles if they're ions? They're charged. They have an electrical charge on them, right? So these are electrolytes. And do they like to dissolve in water if they have a charge?
No.
Yeah, they do. Yeah, they do. Right? If they have an electrical charge, they're polar, they like to dissolve in water. Right. But what can you tell me about this environment right here, the inside of the membrane, the interior space of a membrane? Hydrophilic or hydrophobic? Hydrophobic. It's hydrophobic. So any polar compound that likes to dissolve in water can't get through this space right here. The cell membrane is going to keep it out. But this might be an ion that we need inside the cell. How does a cell get this ion from the outside to the inside? All right, can it use diffusion?
No.
Take a look at this. Low concentration here, intracellular, high concentration extracellularly. So could diffusion be used to move from high concentration to low?
Yes.
And the answer is yes, but there's a barrier. It can't, right? It wants to, but it can't because of this hydrophobic region in a membrane. But here's a special protein that's going to allow this to happen, right? It forms a tube from the inside to the outside of the cell. Normally, we'll say that this tube is closed, right? It's occluded, so there is no space that connects the intracellular and extracellular space. But under certain circumstances, this protein can change shape. It can change conformation. So now it opens up, and there is now a tunnel from extracellular to intracellular. And when this protein opens up, what happens to these ions? They move from high to low. Passively, that's what we call diffusion. They enter the cell. All right, so sometimes, well, we would call this a channel. And sometimes if a channel is open or closed, we call it a gated channel. So this acts like a gate. It can either be open or it can be closed. And this will allow for diffusion to take place. If the channel is closed, no diffusion takes place. As soon as it opens, we do have motion. All right, so what is the rate of diffusion related to? I want to talk about something. I'm going to turn a light on and not blow something up. Wrong way, like this. I have a marker. All right, this is going to entail a little algebra, which is math. All right, so let's just write this equation on the board. Right, let's talk about something we're going to look at a lot. Let's say flow, blood flow, is going to be equal to something. All right, it's going to be equal to the force that can move water around. Okay, and we're going to call that pressure. And it's also going to be related to something that will inhibit this flow, and that is resistance. All right, so this is the reason why I wrote this equation down. How does flow relate to pressure? It is related according to this equation right here, and you have two choices. It's either directly related or inversely related. Is pressure directly related to flow?
No.
And the answer is yes, because if you increase pressure, what happens to flow? It increases as well, right? So that's what we mean by directly related. Increase pressure, increase flow. Now, what about resistance here? It is not directly related, it is inversely related, which means if you increase resistance, what happens to flow? It decreases, right? So that's the important concept. Inversely related variables, right, oppose each other. Directly related parameters, okay, add together, right? So increase pressure, increase flow. Increase resistance, decrease flow. Now we're going to be looking at diffusion instead of that simple equation right there. Okay, the rate of diffusion, how fast a molecule moves from one place to the other, is directly related to the concentration gradient, which means if we increase the concentration gradient, the difference between molecules from one area to another, what happens to diffusion if we increase the concentration gradient? It increases because it's directly related, right? And diffusion, the rate of diffusion is directly related to permeability of the membrane. So if the permeability increases, what happens to diffusion? It increases. And temperature, if we increase temperature, what happens to diffusion? It increases. If we decrease temperature, what happens to diffusion? It decreases. It goes the same way. Okay. And as the membrane gets bigger, the surface area of the membrane gets bigger, and it's directly related, what happens to the rate of diffusion? It increases as well. So all of these things can either increase or decrease the rate of diffusion, right? And increase the rate of diffusion if these parameters increase as well, because they are directly related. All right, there's one other thing. The rate of diffusion is inversely related to one thing, and that is the molecular weight. Molecular weight is really just the size of the molecule. And as the molecule gets bigger and bigger, what happens to the rate of diffusion? It slows down. All right, so here are a number of things that vary directly, and there's one thing that varies inversely with the rate of diffusion. So that's a lot about diffusion. Let's go to the next topic, and that is osmosis. And there are three. Is it time to go? 12:45, exactly time. Oh, and I didn't put the sign-in sheet around. Okay, so next week I promise I'll have a sign-in sheet for you. So were you all here today? Yes. Okay, and so we're going to start here, osmosis, next time. I need to get a clock that works in here.